All right, guys, before today's episode, just a wee reminder that we have tickets on sale for our next Summer Off Live show at the Pavilion Theatre on Sunday, the 31st of March.
Yes. Please come. Please come along. It's going to be great. We also have a Patreon.
Yes. Over there, you can get extra content. Every couple of weeks, we do an extra episode. They're always fun. There's all the live shows that we've done from Glasgow, Edinburgh, London. They're on there. And you'll get early tickets for the next ones.
Yeah,
right?
Extra episode every 2 weeks. And for as little as £3 a month, you can get access to all that. You can also see all of our stand-up specials. Myself, Steve and Stuart, who are all on the one camera squeezed into this couch right now.
Yeah, it's a very sweet image.
The video listeners is...
I was saying it's like that picture Kirst took of us that we have for the Pavilion.
Yes, it's like the Pavilion promo photo. Do you want to recreate it? What did you do, Steve? Did you put your hands on either of our faces like this?
Just kind of squeezed it.
Which, like that. A Greek man did call us a homophobic slur for that on Instagram.
Oh my goodness.
I think he let himself down there, that Greek
man.
Well,
listen, guys, if you want to support the opposite of that, which is us, you can sign up to the Patreon, watch all our stand-up specials on the YouTube channel as well. And we'll hopefully see you at the Pavilion. But aside from all that, guys, enjoy today's episode.
Cheers, guys. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Some Laugh Podcast.
It could be like, oh, that was some laugh, or there was just some laughs. Some laughs.
Well, no promising all laugh.
No, there's going to be some.
It's some laugh.
She was saying when he met us all the first time.
I don't know what this story is, but I can only imagine it's not going to reflect me well on me. Well,
why do you think that is, Mark?
I don't know, but I'm assuming, because you want to bring it up. When was the first time you met me, Stuart?
I met you at Tennant's Bar in Glasgow. Well, sure. I never met you because you walked right by me.
I was too intimidated by your comedy sort of
prowess.
Do you know the worst thing? I went for the handshake as well. You went straight by me. I was like, no, that's what I'm worth.
I was too intimidated by that as well.
No, probably. God, you don't want to hear that.
Tennis Bar, man, I used to do so many gigs in that, doing this in the basement when we started it.
Yeah, it's not a... It used to be because it was a Tuesday night and you would... At that stage, we'd be doing Red Raw and you'd have the gig of
your life. Lucky.
If you were lucky. And then you'd double up at Tenants and just go from there down to like a fucking 2 hour.
It's not a good
gig.
Room for comedy.
It's a horrible room.
No, bad. No. Is it actually Tenants that sponsor it, or is it just called basement? Tenants?
I don't know.
Must be connected, surely.
Must be.
Surely. Is it the same spelling?
I think the cunt who started Tenants owned that bar or something, or somebody in his family. So it was something to do with them, but... It's a good name for a pub, to be fair.
Tenants, yeah. Suppose, wrong.
But then you're painting yourself into a corner. If people don't like Tenants, they might not go there.
That's right.
Yeah, this is true. But they don't exclusively do that.
That's why you get Brewdog.
Everyone loves them, yeah. They're doing great stuff.
All the pricks.
used to be popular. I actually know them randomly.
Do you?
At Stirling University, I did a five-a-side football business. And I was part of an awards night and we came runner up and Brewdog won. But they were just like a double act. They weren't like an actual massive business. They were
I thought you were
going
to say there were two aside.
There
was just two of them. And they went on and then we all went to the regional final in London and we both got beat off a company called Beautiful Vending. And they did the hair straighteners and girls' toilets, and you put a pound in and then straightened your hair. Genius. Till folks started like burning their face with straighteners.
So you had a five-a-side football business.
What is that?
So it was called Fives with a Z. See what I did?
That's cool. Yes, that's good.
Yeah, so
and was it like to rival goals websites. And stuff?
It was to rival goals and Power League.
Right,
and it done really well. And
so you had your own pitch and stuff.
No, so we utilised council facilities that weren't getting used.
Right.
And then we ran leagues. So we took a full-size pitch and split it up to four parks.
Right.
Mm. And we only ran half an hour games.
Right.
So you used to have like almost like eight games in an hour. Right. And then it was good, profitable, well, good. And then sold it on. And
did you?
I sold it on when I was 24.
Fuck's sake. So who did you sell it to?
I sold it to my cousin.
I thought you were going to say goals or something.
No, I did. I sold it to my cousin and it's now worth about 5 million.
Are you kidding?
No, really?
I sold it for 15 grand.
Have you got any?
And my cousin always turns up at these events with like a matte great suit and all that. And then I'm turning up with like my dead dad's fucking tracksuit.
Still for the five sides. So, but could you not have kept a stake in the business?
I never thought. I was too young. Like, I was really young. I didn't really know what still, I was doing. And then my other cousin, he set up a rival. So one of them's called Leisure Leagues and the other one's called Soccer Sixes, and they like compete against each other.
It's like pure Scottish version of Succession or something.
That's what I done when I left Stirling Uni.
Aye.
That's class.
Did you know you used to be in, I remember seeing a video of you doing all this politics stuff and all that as well. What was that you were involved in when you were younger?
Aye, so that was with John Boyle. That was called Tricky Business. And,
right.
And John Boyle was helping us to grow our five-a-side football business.
Right.
To eventually sell it on, which I did. And then I was being mentored by a guy that Zoom Airlines then fucking went bust. Like, during the show, his company went under and he's telling me how to sell my business. I'm like, yours literally fell out of the sky, you mad bastard.
What were you studying?
I studied economics.
Right,
I started with accounts and then I went to the Treasury in London with a gap year to work with Gordon Brown. And then I switched to economics. Aye, good. He's only got one eye, though. He's got a glass eye.
That's right.
That's why they say he took his eye off the economy, because they never... I've had a bit of a mad one. So I went to Stirling and then done 2 years there and then managed to get into this, one of 10 students. Did that for 6 months and then get transferred to the Scottish Executive at the time.
When was this, before or after the crash?
This was well before. I was in banking when the crash happened.
Were you?
You're part of the problem.
It's just like some kind of reverse Forrest Gump situation.
You've caused all these terrible things to happen.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So,
did you sell the economy to your cousin? $15,000. It was worth a lot, man.
He was sitting with a house lot. So that's what I sort of worked across the public sector, private sector, and then I had joined the charity sector as well.
Aye, because you used to run those gigs or something. You used to do that charity stuff. What was that again?
Aye, so I set up a prison volunteer programme.
Uh-huh.
So it was a rehabilitation scheme where prisoners, when they were coming to the end of their sentence, they volunteered in charity shops.
All right.
Like, to give something back to the community.
Yeah.
But it's all changed now. Like, prisoners can get jobs while they're on the inside.
Really?
Aye, so they don't need to volunteer. Do you know the
what
big
you mean?
Well, so when you're due to get released,
yeah,
you get released on licence, it's called, right? So you literally walk about with a wee bit of paper to show the police, if you get stopped, that I'm actually meant to be here, I'm not meant to be in my cell. It's like the weirdest thing. It's got like a wee picture of them. So you get released on licence and it's trust that you'll leave the prison in the morning, go to your work placement, then come back at night. And it's to prepare them.
Brutal, like getting to go out of jail, but just to do some work, and then you have to go back.
It's better stay in the showers.
But, do you have a pub lunch at least?
Well, the thing is, they get recalled. So if you go to like McDonald's, you've got to follow a specific route.
Oh.
And a lot of them are tagged. So if you go off route, it alerts, and then they get recalled.
Does MD just fucking try and go for do it?
You'll get folk that will do a runner, but it's always something like, it's always like quite sad what they've done. Like, they've went to see like their daughter or their son or their elderly parent or something like that. It's never, very rarely does somebody just, because they're going to get out anyway in 12 months. So why would they leave
the country or something?
But it's ironic because since like Brexit and all unskilled labour's left the country, you've got all these companies recruiting directly from prison.
Really?
Aye. So you don't know about it because they don't shout. The only company that shouts about it is Timpsons.
Yeah,
that's not who you want cutting your key.
Do you know what I mean?
Mental. There's only one copy asked for me. Why are you doing
that? Right, what's your address? No, but to be fair, like, Timpsons are like really good. They've got like a foundation, and they're amazing. Like, the guys that work there are just, if you ever been into a Timpsons, like, the customer service is incredible, and I think they've got like 25% of their staff's been recruited from prison. So that's what I've always done, because when I was younger, I nearly went down that route. Like, I nearly ended up in Pullman, Did you? I know the town. Like, wouldn't stay there.
Is Pullman near the? Is it?
So Young Offenders prisons in Pullman. So
I've done a gig there before.
Aye.
Have you done one?
I've done one there as well.
It was so weird, because I don't know if I spoke about this on here before, but you do two gigs, so you do one what they call protection.
That's right.
Which is the pedos, or is them or people who are like for gangster family, anybody who would be in danger of getting fucking chibbed or whatever. Aye. And then you do the mainstream, and I was gutty because I went down better with the pedos.
That's amazing. You're all younger than me, so that makes sense.
It was weird because at the time I was like, my material was like, I love my parents, driving, and what, and
but they only relate to living with their parents.
In a call centre. I'm like, well, they couldn't relate to him. And his drive, no. But so, do you mind telling us how you nearly ended up in Pullman?
So it's a bit depressing. Well, it's not depressing. Right. I think so. My mum passed away when I was 7, and I just like it never hit me till I was like 10 or 11, and then I just get into the wrong crowd. I was at like 12, 13, I was taking like drugs and drinking quite heavily.
Aye.
And my
where
dad,
did you grow up again?
Edlin Lithgow.
Aye, right. Uh-huh.
Aye, so if there's anybody listening, how you doing? But I think
You and Alex Salmon, the
aye, me and Alex Salmon. Aye, and that old MP, what was his name? Tam DL. Do you remember him?
No.
Tam DL, for the older listeners, they'll know Tam DL. So I think my dad just decided enough. My sister got suspended and then expelled from school. And my dad just decided that enough's enough. So he took me from where I was taking drugs and we moved to Lanarkshire. that was an experience. And then I think when we moved to Lanarkshire, that's when I really started actually going to school.
Aye.
Because there was a lot of and then just sort of gradually built up there. I'm severely dyslexic as well, but that wasn't diagnosed till I went to university.
Really?
So I really have to think what I'm saying and that's all the time, and that's why we work that we all do. In the background, people don't understand the work I need to do extra to make sure that I'm actually in a good place.
That's so interesting because you're a kind of one-liner comic, so it's all about the words and the wording. So do you think that because you've had to concentrate on that more is why, like, you've got that certain style? Because you would almost think it'd be harder today the way you do if you're dyslexic or whatever.
I think it's more learning. So I think the creative process is actually, that's where my strong point. So been really specific about the structure of jokes and changing words and punchlines and left turns and all that. But where I struggle is learning and processing and no saying the punchline before the setup.
that's where
the extra work comes in. So like if you're doing like panel show or whatever, I need to like up it. I'll maybe write and then I'll need to do more of the learning than the actual writing.
Oh, really?
To know. So that's why, like, improvising shows I don't feel I'm great on. Because the worst thing that ever happened and it's taught me a lesson was it. So I love Lee Mack because I think he's so well off the cuff. Uh-huh. And I done a radio show down in London, my first Radio 4 panel show. And there was a lot of improvisation, like there was no script given.
Right.
In terms of what you had to do, first of all,
because people
like,
probably maybe don't know, but usually when you do these types of panel shows, that you get some kind of brief, at least maybe a day or so before, so that you can prepare some jokes. Because otherwise, it would just basically be like a podcast or something where you're just kind of riffing.
That's right, you get it and send it to your writers. And no, don't have a luxury of that.
But most people do. It's usually you.
We can talk about that. But I think do you know that way? Well, maybe you don't know. Maybe it's just me. But do you know that way when you're doing a gig or you're doing a panel show or whatever, and in your head you know it's not going well because you just know the audience aren't reacting to you.
And
I knew that. And then, of course, I got off stage and who's watching?
Lee Mack.
My performance was Lee Mack.
Oh,
fuck's sake.
And I got off and he said, oh, well, I enjoyed that. And do you know that way you just know he's been polite? And then ever since then, I've really just doubled up on making sure that for any shows, like this is amazing because we just turn up and talk. Like, you don't have to do any prep or whatever. Apologies if you had to.
Sorry. Oh, did you not get the brief?
No. Never get a fee. But I think with that, that just hit home that that's never happening again, in terms of just throwing myself into that situation.
Mm. Yeah, and do you know those moments are good sometimes with that? See, when you do have a sort of spectacular failure, or you kind of just feel embarrassed, maybe in front of somebody you admire, whatever, it does spurn you on, because you do just go, I'm going to fucking make sure it never happens again. Because the other option is fucking gee up.
I remember as well, like, we've all done it, like, we're breaking the news as well. The first ever episode I done, I was on with Phil Jupitus.
Wow.
He was, like, beside me.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had just passed away, like, 10 days before the show.
Fucking hell, man.
And they were deciding, do you know what I mean? I'm thinking, oh, God, there's no way I'm cancelling this. Mm-hmm. And I always remember, like, them. They were
need somebody else to carry that call.
Right, exactly. So it was, the producer was trying to sort of say, look, I don't think you should be on this show. And I'm like, look, I'm doing it.
Aye.
I'm doing it. I'll miss the funeral. But I think, no, so I was, that's sort of the key lesson for me, just to be prepared and don't let anything throw you as well.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So you mentioned, obviously, your dad and your mum. You're an orphan.
I'm an orphan. Stuart. Well, 32. I was 32, come on. No, as if I was, what, 6?
I don't think there's an age limit, is there, to being described as an orphan?
Aye. You have to be in a home, a children's home, I think, don't you?
You have to be.
Aye.
Aye, they wouldn't give me the meals. So, I think it's interesting, because everyone... Do you know that Scottish people will say to you, they're like, oh, that's terrible. You lost your parents or not, and you're thinking, it's just a Scottish thing. You got all through my life, like, friends and family have always told me how bad my life has been, and I'm like, give me a break.
If you're telling that story about selling the fives to your cousin, maybe I could understand. That is terrible to be.
Poor luck.
You spoke about your folks in one of your friend shows a few years ago, and this was always what I was curious about, because you do. Like, you obviously do one-liners. Like, I always remember the one I always think about with you, the joke you said, oh, my grand died in a rail accident and I feel terrible because I was the one that put up her curtains. But I was always like, is that show just going to be an hour of that? Or like, was it a case of, did you have to try and get your comfort zone to talk about that sort of stuff? And do be a bit more personal and that kind of thing?
So the first show was the greatest hits.
Right.
So my debut was like the greatest hits that I'd done. And then the second...
When did you start a comedy show?
When did I start? Yeah. So it was 2009.
Right.
So quite a long time ago. It was
15 years ago now.
Thanks for reminding me. My mouse like, oh, come on. I did a competition. I'd done the Laughing Horse new act. It was called at the time.
So that was your first ever gig?
My very first gig, guy. Right. Ian Stirling won the heat. Fuck knows where he went. I got reviewed and it said the best opening line of a first gig ever. And it was there was a massive green light on the stage, and I walked on and I went, oh, thank fuck, Superman's no gigging. Right? Which I thought was terrible.
Aye.
But obviously somebody in the audience thought it was funny. But I started in 2009. So first Fringe was greatest hits, and then my agent at the time was like, you need to do something personal. You need to talk about something personal. And I persevered with it because before they tried to really push me to go in Britain's Got Talent.
Oh, right.
And I auditioned, but get right through, and then they said you're going to have to talk about your mum.
Really?
And I was like,
oh, like as like the VT
dying, really sad, and the sad.
And I was
sad,
like, I'm not doing that at all, unless you put me through. So the golden buzzer. I want the golden buzzer. I did the follow up, Gordon Ramsay's Karma Cafe, and that was all about mum and dad passing away. And you know that way. I wanted to do something that I wouldn't do in the clubs.
Yeah.
And then I realised the show was something I shouldn't have done at all. No. But it's ironic because the first show, I think a lot of comedians talk about this, but see my debut show, but I spent 6 years on it in terms of building up all that material.
Mm-hmm.
And everything hit, like everything was great. It was an hour, it was great. Audience loved it, and the reviews were all right.
Aye.
Like 3-4 stars, whereas the the personal show, the audience were a bit like, you know how they come up and say, oh, it wasn't what I was expecting, but I still enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And you saw it.
Lee Market, that one was.
Exactly.
Well done, Stuart.
Brilliant. So, it was weird because the critics liked it, but the audience weren't. And ironically, yeah, that show formed the basis of then what's going on to be sort of radio show.
Radio 4?
Radio 4, yeah.
And you've got that coming out shortly?
It's in 25th of February. It's
coming out. Nice one, eh? And what is it, like 6 episodes or something?
It's 6 episodes. Stuart Mitchell, Cost of Living, it's called.
Right.
And I know that it's a weird title, Cost of Living, because we're in like a cost of living crisis, but it's all about, for me...
Thanks, Gordon Brown.
Aye, thanks, Gordon Brown. Exactly.
He's still the Chancellor, right?
No, exactly. But for me, it's all about... It talks about the cost of actually living, because when I was in banking, I made a lot of money.
Right.
But I was in a really dark place.
Mm.
And I gave it all up to join the charity sector and start the prison programme, because that was something I really wanted to do in terms of giving something back that I felt I needed.
Yeah.
So that's what I done. But it was a really personal show, and I was a really when I first started comedy, I was like not a nice person.
Oh really?
So
that's why I walked by you, by the way.
Exactly.
I heard stories, so I don't know.
Exactly. So I found it really sort of tough in terms of I had a really good sports car, and I'd be turning up to gigs in like the sports car, and sort of, I booked my first Edinburgh run for the August when I only started in like the February.
Uh-huh.
Right.
That's a mistake a few people make.
It's a classic.
And I think
where did you do your first Edinburgh?
Oh God, I done it in Frankenstein. Frankenstein?
Aye, that one in the fucking thing comes down for the roof and all that.
Do you know who was in there this year? It was Bobby Davro.
Oh really?
Yeah. I didn't go, so I can't speak for the show. But.
No, wasn't it? It was a Jekyll and Hyde. Actually, I'm talking. Is that the same pub?
Oh, aye.
No,
Jekyll and Hyde. Is that the other like along of it?
I always remember you doing that, because Fern done that with Peter Brush. I remember her doing a show there. I don't think I actually ever went to that Jekyll and Hyde, mind you, but I remember you doing shows there at that time.
Or yeah, maybe. I don't know if they use it anymore, do they?
Fuck no, I don't even know where it is, to be honest. But
I'm sure it's Newtown, like kind of near our stand.
So. Right. Anyway, that's by the by.
But I think it's interesting because I sort of get into that. What would I say? I threw everything at Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So the first show I did the courtyard, got the PR.
Well, this is what I was thinking, because you were saying about the money. I would imagine you'd spent money.
So when I first started comedy, I was sort of just in banking, and then I had like all this money, but see, with money comes, you just want more.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
So I was spending and spending and spending and spending, and then the credit crash hit, and then that was it. Like everything, like my income just got turned off, and everything just went to crap when I started. And obviously, that's what happens. That's why you start being a comedian. So I lost everything in terms of car. Was on a debt arrangement scheme. And just like totally floored.
Wow,
and then split up with my long term girlfriend at the time, who's now with my best mate. So it was hard at the time, but she's happily married and I'm happily married and I'm no better.
So, are you still mates with him?
No, not at all. not at all.
So that was your start in comedy, and so what did you do after that when you lost your mum? Did you just decide that you're going to just need to really kind of work at comedy as your sort of main focus?
Aye, so I think, obviously I lost my mum at 7, so fairly young. And then my dad remarried and they had a kid, Alistair, who's now like 25.
Hmm.
And I felt as if, like, it's no disrespect to them, but because he was there, like, that's why people will say I get into comedy, because I wasn't really getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
So I wanted that on stage and audiences to almost like me.
Yeah.
And then, I was just always like, see, until my dad like was diagnosed, and it came as obviously a massive surprise. And then until he died, I was always just striving to get it, something. And it didn't matter what was in the way, I was just going to smash right through it.
Yeah.
And I just now looking back, I feel as if I need to talk about it, and I talk about it in the Radio 4 show.
Yeah.
Because it's really important how I've changed. But I think I was just so, I wanted to get something. I wanted to be famous. I wanted to get to the top no matter who I hurt.
Yeah.
Or how I got there. And it was just really a really bad place to be in, just really toxic and just been really bitter about how they getting that, how they getting this.
So just give you more perspective, made you reevaluate what was important to you in life.
Absolutely. Scene, I think that it does that to you, like until it really happens to you, like my dad was just like, you couldn't get a better guy, what he'd done for people.
Uh-huh.
And if he knew what I was like,
right,
he would have been really sort of pissed off, really. So that just changed everything. And then ever since then, I've just tried to do the right thing all the time and done a lot of things as well that I think you do, but you just keep it to yourself because then it's more rewarding as well. But I'll tell you. No. So I just loads of things like that, and I think it's so important to do that.
Was that like a gradual thing, or was that like a sort of overnight thing I'm going to change? Or?
Yeah, it was an instant thing, really. I don't want to get too weird, but I always remember because we'd had a lot of death in our family, like it's weird because you go to the Undertakers in Hamilton and they like knows you how you're doing.
The usual.
Exactly. That is brilliant. I love that. Absolutely love that. And but it's funny because I was like that with. Like I was like, I was like, I would go in and look at the folk there and I'd be like, so is he up the day? Is he on his breakfast sort of thing? And it was weird because, but obviously, dad had sort of terminal cancer, and obviously, towards the end, they don't look the same. But what they'd done, like to him, I was like, God's sake, I want you to do my break the news maker. I just went in and I sat for 2 hours and had a conversation with my dad when he never said anything back. And that was the real turning point for me. And I don't want to get sort of philosophical certain things that
like philosophy on this show.
There's certain things that's happened in my life since my dad's passed away where I thought that's meant to happen.
Yeah.
So like a lot of comics, I'm sure there was after COVID, I was probably 3 or 4 days for giving up.
Really?
Yeah.
During COVID, did you say, or just
no,
after?
No, after COVID, right. So me and my wife, we never get any financial support during COVID. We never get a penny.
You weren't paying your taxes?
Aye, exactly. Exactly. Wasn't getting any money for that business or something. Stop playing football, you bastard. That was the only thing, like my cousin, he owned that football business, and during COVID they couldn't play football. I was like, "Grab me!" Turn out to me, you prick. Sorry. But I just thought, no, enough's enough. Like we used, like during COVID, like we used all our savings.
Yeah.
Everything. And then also after my dad, after my dad was diagnosed, I took a hiatus, is that what you say?
Yeah.
I took a 6 months
sabbatical. Perhaps.
I took a 6 month break from him. I was due to tour Australia for 3 months and I got a part in Shetland, BBC show.
Did you?
And my dad was like, you need to, if you do one thing, I want you to do this, son. And then I was at Glasgow Airport to fly to Shetland and I got a call that he'd taken a really bad turn and he died like two days later. So I had to cancel that. But do you know that thing? Like that was the best decision I ever made.
Aye.
Because if I'd went and done that and I'd have been devastated. So that for me was, I was thinking giving up. So I had to pull the tour, Australia, I had to pull Shetland, everything just collapsed on the comedy front.
Yeah.
But at the same time I felt as if I was there for my dad. And the other thing was that was a positive out of that is I feel that, so people always say, oh, did you grieve for your dad? Did you bereavement and all that? And I think when my dad was diagnosed 6 months before he passed away, that was part of the whole bereavement process for me.
Yeah, totally.
So when he passed, I knew within myself, and a lot of people don't have that I couldn't have done any more that I'd done, like gave that up, felt it was important. And that just, since my dad passed away, it was just like a switch. It just clicked. And I talk about it in the the radio show that's coming out,
mm-hmm.
and it all falls back to I tell this story. It's very strange. So my dad used to work for Singer Sewing Machines.
Yeah, oh, right.
Clyde Bank.
Oh,
right.
Wow.
So he had a shop in Edinburgh, and he used to go out to repair sewing machines in people's houses. And the policy of Singer was, see if your machine wasn't working, you'd take it back to the workshop and you'd charge them, right? You'd just rip them. I was going to say stitch them up. That's terrible. Right, sorry, that's terrible. So
that's a classic ritual. That's
a classic material. Anyway, we're not dead, but this is
I'd happily just say
this is conversation. So I always remember we went to heard the Bathgate, right?
Aye.
Ferns from Bathgate.
I've done the Regal Theatre there.
The Regal Theatre.
I got heckled by Susan Boyle there once.
Really?
Because you know how when you do the Regal Theatre, you're not actually doing the theatre, you do a wee cafe next to it. And then in the main hall was like every year in Bathgate, they have like the wee kids for the local area come and sing a song. But Susan Boyle goes every year and then she goes up with them. And so I was on stairs closing this gig and here he hears, oh, I dreamed, I'm trying to run by it. Like everybody, including me in that room, is like, I just want to go next door. I'm like, what is this? This is fucking weirdest thing.
I had the worst experience with Susan Boyle.
All right.
Children in Need. I was doing the Children in Need warm up and Susan Boyle was on.
Uh-huh.
And Jackie Bird was obviously hosting.
Right.
And they said, now, and to be fair, they said, look, Susan's going to come Susan's going to come out. Just don't talk to her because she'll be so focused and all that, right? And they brought Pudsey out. Uh-huh. And I said, Susan, that looks like a bit of a warm uniform you're wearing. But she was standing behind me with her agent, and I turned around and her agent was like furious. Like, just stared like, me. Oh, God. It's just insane.
Okay. Anyway, Bathgate.
Yeah, so sorry, Bathgate. So I always remember, like, do you know childhood memories like stick in your mind? Like, there's always something. And we went into this woman's house because obviously my mum had passed away and my dad would have to take me sometimes on his, like, what would I say, when he was repairing machines to go and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to this old woman's house. We went in and our machine wasn't working. And as I say, rather than taking it away and charging her, my dad noticed that the needle in the machine all you had to do was the needle was round the wrong way.
Oh, right.
And he could have easily just bumped her rotten, right? I would have, right? I would have at the time.
Aye.
If I was still in banking, I would have bumped her. But he turned the needle in and he never charged her anything, right? And I always remember that. And then I was walking out and she gave me a fiver.
Aye.
And I always remember, like, and it stuck. It wasn't until years later I thought, do you know, that woman was rewarded that day. My dad was rewarded for his kindness and I ended up with a fiver.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, that's the way we should all be living our life. Like, given, and then in the end it'll all come back.
Yeah.
You pretend you gave your cousin the fiver-size business for cheap.
Exactly.
As an act of charity.
It'll come back to me. That's right. If when he passes away, I'll get it back. But I think that was a key, it was a key change.
Yeah,
and I get criticised a bit during Edinburgh because folk were like, "Oh, dead dad show, it's been done before."
Yeah, everyone says that.
I hate that criticism as if only one person gets to have a dead dad.
I was like, somebody's done a show about my dead dad. Did I miss this? And I always used to say my show was, I was two for one because it was about my mum and dad.
But what was the moment then you're saying about, like, you were a couple of days away from quitting and all that, and then what was it that changed for you there?
In terms of...
It was just that, like, a change of mindset?
That, like, watching, like, the pain and hurt and misery my wife went through during COVID,
uh-huh.
in terms of the kids' entertainer she had, and it was, everything was on and it was off and it was on and it was off.
Yeah.
Not getting any funding and having to... We'd just bought a new house and having to use all our savings, and I was working for Track and Trace to make ends meet and it was just awful. And I just thought, and then we fell my wife fell pregnant when we were never expect. We were told we couldn't have kids, like absolutely, that even IVF wouldn't work. And then by a miracle, we had Morgan was due on the way, and I thought it was that responsibility thing.
Sure.
So I was really close to just giving up. And then
what would you have done? Yeah. Do you think if you gave up comedy?
Back to being a bastard again.
A bastard. Do you know, it's a really good question. I would have stayed. Like, I would have liked to have stayed in the charity sector and doing something like that, I think. Mm-hmm. Or starting a business, what it would be, I don't know. But I think off the back of that. But it just changed. It never went anywhere in the end, but mm-hmm. I got a format sort of picked up and optioned, and that was like a wee sign. And then there was just wee drips. And then again, before the Radio 4 series came through, I was thinking again. I was pitching things and it was just getting knocked back all the time.
Yeah.
But I know this is a numbers game, and you just got to keep going and keep going.
Yeah.
Because I remember Susan Kilman like talking about it, like she was pitching like 35 things.
Yeah.
Like a month, and I was like, that is nuts. Like it's nuts. But something else came in, and then it's all of a sudden. I would say I'm genuinely now. People say this, but genuinely now I'm probably in the happiest place I've ever been, and always trying to do the right thing, so it's good. So it's all great. Downward for here.
Well, you mentioned your partner, and obviously you mentioned that she works in kids entertainment. So because it used to be the singing kettle back in the day that she was in.
So it used to be the singing kettle, and then as I say on stage at the Zen Fun Box, which was hilarious because that's just a weird name for a kid. So singing kettle and then Fun Box, and then obviously if people will know from maybe seeing my comedy or other comedians that we met when I played Bible John.
That's a great story.
So how did that go exactly? Because that's it's quite an interesting kink to have.
So the Bible John. Do you want me to tell the actual story?
Aye.
So what happened was, is absolutely true story. I was walking through Glasgow and there was people scouting to find Bible John.
Why would you do it guy? In the street?
The real guy? Aye,
so they were from, they were producers, production company.
Aye.
Somebody
play him, just to be clear, though, not just the actual murderer.
They're looking for who killed.
And they're obviously handed.
Bonus,
they get criticised for it. STV at the time criticised for it because it wasn't a paid role at the time. It was eventually.
Right.
Because I think they were trying to just find Bible John and do some documentary drama about him. Mm-hmm. But they were handing it pictures, and the guy was like, oh, God, you quite look like him. Would you mind going for that?
He looks like weird, doesn't it?
So that's,
I was going to say, you look a wee bit like Lee Mackie.
I went for the casting, and I always say like my dad's genuinely, he get interviewed as part of the Bible John investigation.
Oh, really?
And I always joke and say, well, Dad, you get interviewed, I get the job. So that's how it happened. So went for the...
So did they think your dad was Bible John at the time?
I think they thought like 101 guys were Bible John. So I think they thought everyone was Bible John.
I think Rab Florence was saying that his uncle was taken in for question to see if he was Bible John, and like his dad was just slagging fuck out him all the time, like, here comes Bible John. Is that the same for your dad?
It's mad. Well, the guy that lives next door to me in Bigger, he's in his late 80s, he was head of CID at Glasgow.
Wow.
And he never dealt with the case itself, but he obviously knew about how big the case was, and that's how it worked. So the first time I met my wife, I had to sexually assault and murder her in the scene. And I had to strangle her to death and all this stuff. And, you know, it was awkward.
Sounds it.
Yeah. It was, because it gave me a size 6 instead of a 7. So I done all that, and then never saw her for 6 months. And then the story I tell on stage, which is absolutely true, because my wife's got a really... Now, comedians' wives or partners have always got a wicked sense of humour. Like, she's genuinely funnier than me.
Aye.
Like, my wife is so funny. And I was out at the rap party, and I was single at the time, chatting a girl up, and she just leant in like this, and she went, see him. He raped me. And then walked away. And then that's I actually told that in my wedding speech. which got a good. So that's how I played Bible John. And it was really interesting and great. And I think they had me like chasing actresses like through the streets in Glasgow, and they hadn't given the police a heads up.
Aye.
So police were turning up. Like saying, what is going on, man? And I'm like running about trying to grab.
Just getting them as unpaid extras and all. <running around. laughs>
But director's so like, that's a line, lassie. Because somebody got to the spa and she's like, what's going on?
So did you see after that happened at that party, did you just then go up to your now wife and we're like, oh, good, good
so, one. No, and then... so I just went up to her and I was like, that was class. Like, that was really, really funny. And and then we just arranged to go a date. We went sort of out in Glasgow.
Aye.
And then just had a date, and that was it. And it was weird because like after 4 days, I told my now wife that I loved her, which was weird.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Cause
big Bible John energy, right there. Yeah.
He was an intense guy.
It was absolutely good. So it was all right. It was good. And then ever since, as I say, we never thought we'd have a kid and get a 2.5-year-old now.
Brilliant, man.
I'm trying to fucking potty train and all that shite. But I don't talk about Morgan and my set really, because no. I feel as if you're sort of stuck as a comedian if you go up and talk about having kids, and then somebody before you just talked about kids.
Yeah, the only thing worse than a dead dad show is an alive kid show.
Aye, alive
in the eyes of the critics.
Aye, absolutely.
And so Stuart, well, one of the things about you as well is and this is what you talk about on stage a lot, or certainly when I first seen you, was your finger.
Yes.
And folk might notice in that. And
yeah.
The story you've got about that on stage, because I said, I don't want to just get you doing all your material, but it's a brilliant story that you tell on stage about that. But it was just, what was it that actually happened with you?
So
losing your finger?
So I dropped him down a siver, a drain,
uh-huh.
at the side of the road. So I had a plastic He-Man sword, and I dropped it in the drain, and my mate, Fraser Brown at the time, picked it up and he let it fall on my hand.
Oh my God.
Is this the same mate that stole your birth?
No, it's not. It's
had a vendetta against you.
That's when Rick stole my digits. The other man's digits went somewhere else. So. That's terrible. So that's how it happened, and aye. I get rushed. That but again, in the show, that caused so as I say, my mum took her own life. That's how she passed away. Mm. And this was part of that in terms of that accident, because she always never forgave herself for that happened. Because okay. She had developed like postnatal depression and all that. You should watch the show, it's funny. but that's what happened. Like, it triggered that again because she couldn't believe that she'd allowed that to happen. But it's like kids are kids. Like,
yeah, kids are running about, you know, and you kind of keep tabs on them.
I remember when I was, we had like we were at my mate's house, and I fucking like dropped my wee sister or something. She had to fucking get rushed to hospital and split her head open and all that, and no, that way it could have been like so much worse. And it's like, but those wee things just happen, and then you can't just fucking blame myself for that, whatever. But
I always remember Stuart Francis. He doesn't do comedy now.
Uh-huh.
I supported him on his tour, and he came up to me after seeing me, and he went, I've got two. I'll don't do a Canadian accent because I can't do it. He said, I've got two for you. He says, why don't you say every time you point out directions, you arrive 100 yards short? And I thought, can I have that?
Brilliant.
He's like, aye. So
what was the other one?
The other one was,
I've seen you use that before, actually. The other one, no work.
He said, and don't even get me started on the dangers of tin pin bowling.
Are people ever weird about that? Or like, would you go up and no mention it on stage or anything? Or do you feel like you always kind of need to mention it just so as people... in case people are thinking, like, if they notice or whatever, do you know what I mean?
Oh, you mean my fingers?
Aye.
Oh, I've been mentioning it for 15 years. No, I don't. So I don't do that routine on stage now.
Yeah.
Unless it's like a really, what would I say? Unless it's like a corporate and you're dying in your arse. I always say to folk, if I pull out the horn, you know it's going bad.
Is that a sure thing, though? Like, as soon as you do that, is that everybody's on board?
So this is my... that is my banker signature routine.
Yeah.
So, and I always, and if it's going really bad, I just put my hand up and I say, "Whoa, look at me losing the tips. I got a manicure through Groupon." And then I say 33% off. And then if that doesn't work, I'm off a stage.
No, that's brilliant, man.
So you do a lot of corporates as well. I wanted to ask you a wee bit about that. Like, yeah. Is that your, I take it that's how you make most of your money. Do you actively seek them out? A lot of comedians hate them, myself included. Mm. Do you thrive off them? Do you like them?
Yeah, I really like this too. I think I've diversed. I would say probably in the last year and a half, I've really diversed a lot.
Right.
So because my dad was an amazing dad, but he wasn't. He was so, because he was single parent for a long time. Working in a singer shop with a nanny that supported
killing all the women, like, well.
Killing all the women. That's a task. What I mean. So what happened to my mother? So
well, I don't know. Who knows?
Drunk again. No, <by emotion.
laughs> took her own life. Right? God, I wish I'd put that in my show now.
That's it.
So I think what's interesting is, so I started off sort of getting involved in corporates, writing material for other comics that were doing corporates.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And then off the back, I guess, of breaking the news and gaining a presence on TikTok, which has been, I only joined less than a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I've got a huge amount of corporates, I would say, like, I'm getting a lot of them.
Off the back of TikTok?
Off the back of TikTok, right. I would say. And any that Des Clark can a day.
Thanks for coming in the day, by the way. I was going to say. Speedy recovery, Des.
What I think he asked you to do the show is, like, I've been in London, I've no other chance to book him, can you do it? That is amazing. But to be fair, watching the show, I did think it's going to get to the stage, it's just going to be sitting here, it's going to be my wife and my Wayne that I've died, and it's a tribute to
It's like in the there was an old David Letterman, and like, because he once cancelled Bill Hicks for like stand up, and the show was too edgy. And then years later, David Letterman got his maw on, and there's an iPod, you know. It's like, yeah. And we love Stuart, and I just don't know why we never booked him.
Brilliant. But I think the reason I got into the corporate space, so my dad passed away in the June, and in the September, I went to the World Comedy Series in Las Vegas. It's like a big writing comedy convention.
Oh, wow.
Right. I'd suggest it to anyone if you're interested in comedy. And I spent maybe about a week, 10 days with a workshop. It was quite an expensive workshop, but it was good. It was all late night comedy writers.
Right. Brilliant.
So you spent like days with them, and you went through the structure of jokes. You wrote jokes for dummy stories or stories in the past, and then you wrote jokes for current events that were coming through. And that was like in the 14, 15 years I've done comedy, that was the best I've ever invested in myself. Like booking to go to Vegas for that.
Because formal writing training, effectively.
And the Americans, even when it comes to joke writing, like, the Americans are the best at it, I think. Yeah, I mean, you just have to look at sitcoms over there in terms of the writing teams.
Yeah.
And that's where I was getting a lot of work writing for comics doing corporates, but also writing for comics, because a lot of comics don't like people knowing that they've got writers.
Yeah.
There's very few that do. And I remember Jeff Norcott was the only one that said, "I don't care if you write for me or not."
It's probably different though for doing corporates or like panel shows or whatever, opposed to doing a fringe show or something.
Your stand up special or whatever.
I drew back, I still do it for certain individuals, but it's weird when you're watching like Mock the Week that's not on now, but you're watching that and like other comics are doing your jokes and they're getting laughs.
Yeah,
that you've wrote. But what, then,
what's that feeling like? Do you get quite jealous, or are you proud? Or
at the start, I was a bit like, but then I thought, no, they're employing me to deliver a service. So do you know what I mean? That's the thing. Like you don't get a cleaner in your house and then they're getting annoyed because they're scrubbing your toilet, sort of thing. You're employed for
just
that.
Just give them all Stuart Francis's jokes.
Exactly. So I think And then it just happened. Like, I think I take it really seriously. So a lot of comics will say, just do your set. Doesn't matter if you're in a corporate situation or the club, just do your set. Whereas I tailor my set to the room.
I think, yeah, that's like always makes a difference when you can do that, you know?
Yeah, obviously don't go up there and do all new material in the room, but you've got to start with addressing the environment. And this is where I think, again, with America and again with the work that I do, so I do some work with CEOs that are looking for opening lines for delivering speeches or delivering presentations at external companies. So they might be doing, I don't know.
I'm just picturing like Steve Jobs or something, like, thank God Spider-Man's not gigging tonight.
Still works. We went well with the fucking laughing horse.
Exactly. So I think with the corporates, it's just always been that I've just enjoyed, like people will say as well, the money's great, but they're crap. I hate it. And I think when you start saying that in your head, you automatically turn up to a corporate thinking, oh God, oh, this is going to go. But if you just turn up with a positive mindset, it'll be fine. And sometimes you just need to expect that you're a hindrance to these people's night.
Yeah.
You're disrupting their night.
Yeah.
Literally, they don't want to listen to you.
Yeah.
They would rather just catch up with their mates, especially when everything opened up again and they'd not saw somebody for 3 years, you know?
Yeah.
So that's where, I just do my thing. I do a briefing call with the client. I write specific material. I look at their website. I get a bit of, info on certain guys in the room.
Yeah.
What's been going on? Like, I did Lovie and Buses recently. I did their big event.
Hope you arrived on time for
that gig. I know. That was some opening gag. But, and I think for them, I actually went with some of their staff and say, so what's been happening? What have they implemented and all this?
Yeah.
So that's what I do. I do a lot of research on that front.
But like, does it ever go badly when you do that kind of thing? Because no way, like, if you go, they'll tell you, oh, fucking the boss, he's fucking cheating on his wife and all that stuff. And then you like, because if you know too much in something that maybe it's like, oh, they all make a joke about somebody. Aye. But you know say it in front of him, it's going to be fucked.
You wouldn't do that.
But something, do you know what I mean? Something along those lines. Like,
you wouldn't do that. Because they said that the directors are never in the office on a Friday.
Right.
And this is a real bugbear, that the directors, they work from home on a Friday. Uh-huh. Right. And then they've now got AI virtual equipment to train bus drivers. Right? So what they do is they obviously sit on a bus with a headset, and then it's quite clever. And then people come on the bus and they've got to react to like an aggressive person and all that. It's very clever, instead of getting actors in to do it or whatever, right?
Correct change on them, mate. It's in a master.
So of course,
pretend they don't see one sticking out their arm driving. We a woman. Pass marks 100%.
But I think it is. It's brilliant in terms of just the meeting the people, and then so I went up on stage and I'm the listing. Like if you're not into comedy, the listing process is when you sort of list things and you try and take a left turn, and I think that's what my key skill is in terms of writing, is finding the left turn. So I knew
it's a real set up punchline style you've got as well.
Set up punchline and really trimming the fat off.
Yeah.
So I knew, so all this stuff, they said this and this. So I thought, right, they've got this AI equipment that they've got, and then the director. So I went up and said, this AI equipment's great. I said, you can put the helmet on and you can see the directors in the office on a Friday. Right? And then that was like my opening line. And then that, as soon as you just, but then it's, I think you get better as well the longer you've been going. Like you're saying, what if it doesn't work?
Uh-huh.
I think you get better as known as a comic and a writer. That'll work. Yeah. You must know something. Yeah. Like you're writing for Breaking the News and you'll be sitting there and you'll be like, that's working.
Yeah.
And you're almost excited to get it out.
Absolutely. I remember there was one time, it was one of the first times I'd done it. And
from Chapel Apples.
No, that was a mad one.
That was incredible.
That was, I wish I'd filmed that, because that was one of those ones where I was like, I'll just date. Do you know what that, like, basically I just pretended that I fucking like was promoting a fake product, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to get, if I just said some actual product they wouldn't be using the BBC. And then, but at the time it was because 8 out of 10 Catstars Countdown was on, and they always bring on a wee hang, and a lot of times the stuff that does well on that is just them doing something stupid. So we had this, there was a question about that, and so I just thought, I'll just keep plugging that I'm trying to sell this product. I just thought, Drumchapel Apple, something like that, stupid. And then there was like a callback at the end, and it was like, oh, if there's one thing you couldn't live without or whatever, and I've done it. And I have probably never had a better reaction than that time. It was unbelievable.
Seeing the all breaking the news, that's probably the best material I've ever written.
I mean, I've got to thank you for that show. And do you know what was nice about it? He didn't even charge me for it. I just gave my fiver.
Not at all. But you know, in these shows as well. But
the one I was actually going to say was another time. It was the guy Brian something, and he used to be the head of politics for BBC Scotland.
Okay.
And I remember as soon as I seen he was on the show, I was like, I'm just going to say, at some point, I'm just going to disagree with him about something and go, I know you're the head of blah, 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 politics, and I'm just a guy that's 29 that loves my mum and dad, but here's why you're wrong, Brian. And then, like, I said that, and it just, again, was just the fact that I just said that to him. Like,
the audacity.
But it was one of those ones, as soon as I thought, and it's annoying because it's like you spend fucking a day writing the actual jokes, and then it's always stuff like that that ends up going better in the room. But but no, you get more of an instinct for it, I would say, for sure.
No, I totally agree. I think... You just, that sort of work that I've done, as I say, in America, just honing the sort of my act. And I still have a relationship where it's really expensive. Like, the Americans know how to charge.
Yeah.
But for me, you don't mind. It's like a consultant, or it's part of my, in banking you called it, or in work you call it, part of your learning and development. And for me, that's an investment in me to just keep striving to get better. Because with a kid now, like, I wouldn't say I'm taking my foot off the pedal. I'm diversifying more.
Sure.
So I'm not doing as many club gigs. I'm doing more corporates. I said I didn't like money, but I fucking love it. I'm just diversifying.
Less charity gigs as well. They don't charge.
Doing one tonight. Can Stu Hurim and Mearns do next? That's not benefit you.
See, just to ask you, and you don't need to answer this if you don't want, but like, see, because you are like such a prolific writer, and I've always admired you as somebody who does put the work in when it comes to stuff, particularly like breaking the news and all that kind of thing. Do you get annoyed when you see comics up there that are maybe a bit more personality, attitude, with maybe weaker material? And do you ever go, fuck's sake, if they go up and they still smash it, and then you're like, you know, because you're going, the material's not great, but sometimes people can just sell a fucking, you know, their persona kind of thing.
No, I admire that.
Yeah.
So I really admire that and watch it, because I am absolutely... Do you know how people start comedy and they'll say, oh, they're a better performer than they are material?
Yeah.
I think I've got better material than I am performer.
Yeah.
Like, that's something I feel I could work on, because we're all looking to get better at what we do. But no, I don't. I find it fascinating, because especially comics that I don't get.
Yeah.
And watching them, like, if you go to the Comedy Store or whatever and you see the sort of bill and you think, oh, this will be interesting. And then they go up and storm it and you think, fair play to you. Like, I don't see, and they probably look at me and say, look at him getting his fucking honour again. I saw that.
Must be struggling.
2 minutes in. Fuck, that's what usually closes on. He's going to put on 20 minutes.
I just had to look at them a certain way. I do it, but it is mad, though, with people, how they sort of move on stage and all that. It's just...
But I think I'm what you, actually, because I don't get enough of that, and I always see myself as more of a writer. And I've got more interested in performance and stuff in the last few years. And you do admire it in other people, but sometimes I'm like, you start picking up a few more performance.
You're speaking, it's getting worse, I'll say that.
Yeah, public speaking's still not great. But then I've done a lot more hosting about the last couple of years, and then sometimes you go, am I just relying on this because I'm fucking not been writing as many jokes? You know what I mean? Like, it's always that balance, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think I actually asked to be taken off a break in the news during COVID, because I didn't. I needed the audience. I needed that energy off the audience.
Yeah.
And it turned. It was more of. Well, it was a podcast, wasn't it?
Yeah, really? Sure. Yeah.
And I just didn't feel it. There's nothing. It's one of my most favourite things to do is a live recording, unless it's improv, Dying Mars. But I think in terms of a scripted show where you can really sit and prepare for the sort of stories that are coming up, because it's obviously it's been in the news that week, so there's nothing better than that.
Is it
feeling,
is it more the writing process you like of that, or is it like being there with the audience and hearing one of your jokes getting a big pop?
I think writing something sometimes an hour before you do it.
Aye.
Or thinking of something in the car driving into the studio.
Yeah.
Or the venue, and you think, oh, that's good. And then actually doing it and getting such a reaction, you think, I just created that an hour ago.
Yeah.
And it's worked. And I think it's quite nice as well that a lot of that stuff will never be seen again.
I know.
Yeah.
One thing I was going to ask you when you're saying about doing the first CEOs and all that, do people ever get in touch with you and try and get advice on writing a best man speech or anything? Or have you got anything that you could tell our audience of, like, is there any do's and don'ts? I think being it right for the environment is a good shout, because anytime I've seen my mates or stuff, I'm always really impressed how good the best man speeches and that are, but it's always because they're just telling stories about them that they know, and that everybody knows the character. Have you got any
sort of
pointers you could give people? I've got it. Right, but that's when it's shite though, when it's the pure shite googled jokes.
So I work for a company called Speechy.
Right.
So they write speeches for CEOs, they write speeches for, but it's very high worth individuals.
Yeah.
Like my cousin. So these people are,
you're writing him a shite one, right?
That's right. Dick. So it's like 600, 700, 800, sometimes £1,000 for a speech, for a best man speech. For me, so you've got father of the bride, you've got groom, and you've got best man speech.
Yeah.
The groom's speech should be, it's called a thank you speech.
Aye.
Because you're thanking everyone in the room, basically. But you're also, for me, the groom should be setting up the best man to have as much success as possible.
Sure.
Because then there's nothing worse than going to a wedding where the best man speech bombs, because everybody talks about it.
Aye.
Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone talks about a wedding where the best man's bombed, and I've been at them, and you still talk about it 10 years later.
Yeah.
So for me,
it's like the one thing you remember, isn't it?
It is. It's the one thing, it's absolutely the one thing you remember. But I think in a best man speech, that's where the opening line is absolutely key.
Yeah. And is that why you always insist on getting a green lighter?
Exactly. There you go. Do you want my horn?
I'm just picturing best men doing that. But...
How much do you really want this to go well? You're on that stank.
Well, that's happened. I did a gig with Mark Nelson, and the guy, it was an after dinner speaker. He got up and he done my medical form. That's prime for me. He done it word for word, and I stood up, and I went, "That's my material."
Who was to doing this?
There was an after dinner speaker.
Really?
He done my medical form.
Oh my god!
And were you going to do that as well? Were you
fucking right? I was. It was there, ready to go. And I went, "That's my material," in front of 350 people at the Sheridan in Edinburgh.
What happened?
And he went, "Eh." I went, "That's my material." And he went, and then he done, and then he come off and he says, if I was any younger, I'd have smacked you in the mouth. And I went, well, if I was any older, I'd smack you in the mouth as well. And Mark was like, what is going on?
You're stealing his material.
I know. Recorded the fact. Oh god.
But what's so what's the, so what would you say then, like, the best man thing would...
So the key thing about a best man speech is you need to have an opening line, so you need to take in the environment of the venue that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And you also need to, so I get them, see the menu, ask what the menu is, ask what the itinerary of the day is, so that when I'm putting together an opening line, I give them five or six options based on what they've got.
Right.
So I get information on the venue, the actual room they'll be in, what they've just eaten, because bearing in mind if they have the food that before,
yeah,
you know what they've just eaten. And it needs to be in the, it needs, you need the audience to believe that you've just said something in the moment.
Yeah.
So the main focus of the best man speech is the opening line. And then, sorry, and then you just go in, you really, the whole flow of it is that you in chronological order, you go into how you first met.
Yeah.
And then you go into sort of moving on, you touch on the stag do, then you move on to the bride.
Yeah.
And when you first met the bride, and then you go into the lovey-dovey in terms of how they'll support each other and love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then you end up with the toast.
Yeah.
And that's it. You might have a closing line, but I think at the end you want it to be quite sentimental.
Sure.
But there's
so a friend show, basically.
That's right. 45-minute mark. Somebody fucking dies in the audience or something. But what you don't want to do is come across as a prick.
Yes.
Because as soon as the audience sniff that you're a wanker, you've had it. You've absolutely had it.
Yeah.
So that's the key thing, and you just don't want to offend anybody.
Aye.
And there's no better feeling as well. So. I mean, my...
What, are you fucking bunch of snowflakes or something?
my wee brother was my best man.
Uh-huh.
Did you write his?
I did, actually. So we went through it because he was nervous about it, and he was only at the time, he was maybe only 18 or something. So we went through it all, and he was good. I didn't know that he said something along the lines of, I'm glad Hannah met Stuart because she was the only one left at one of his pals. Didn't he run off with her? So, but I think it's really important, and the best man speech can really make a huge impact, because if you've got a group of mates, that's another thing. Never play to the stag do.
No.
No, yeah, well, everyone else doesn't give a fuck.
Nobody gives a shit.
No.
Like 95% of the audience are sitting there thinking, what?
And nobody wants to think about what might have gone on there, and that you've all got a wee secret or something like that kind of shit.
I'll not name names, but I've been to a wedding where the best man has joked about one of the stag do going out with the lassie that's marrying the groom. And the room were just like,
fuck's sake.
Like, just totally gone.
Yeah.
So, but you do a lot. The other thing is, you do.
Never
you
slag do, the bride as well.
Never slag, like, just don't be a dick.
Yeah.
So you write the speech, and then as part of the what would I say, up service, you can have a coaching service where you go through the delivery of it.
Sure.
Okay. How much to charge for this kind of thing?
Yeah, this is a promotion. Huh?
No.
This week we're sponsored by...
Mark can do Drum Chapel Apples next.
It's a promotion. It's not a promotion because I do it, but it's not really something... I'm quite lucky enough where I like to focus my time on other things. Yeah. I'd rather write for myself or try and pitch something than sort of forgive the fee of doing that.
Aye.
Because it's better in the long term, but if it comes in and I'm free and I can squeeze it, and I'll do it.
Yeah. And talking to that then, so stuff you've been doing since COVID, you have been doing stuff on TikTok and all that. Mm. You've been doing... Have you been putting up a lot of your own stand up and stuff? Like, I have seen a lot of those clips.
Yeah.
So you've been doing that, and obviously you've got the stuff now you do with Raymond Burns, who's obviously been on here.
Mm-hmm.
The Glasgow Da stuff and all that. So talk to me a wee bit about what you've been doing there and how that's been going.
Yeah. So I've been burning a lot of material from my original Fringe show on TikTok.
The best of one.
I've been chopping all that up and sharing it on TikTok, and then I've been doing live shows at Blackfriars in Glasgow as well, and half of the show is interaction with the audience, which is very good for TikTok.
Yeah.
And then half of the remaining half is me testing stuff.
So do you do like a break in between or something like that? Or? No.
So I just go up and I just speak to the audience.
Aye.
That takes 25-30 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll just say to them, I'm going to try some new stuff. Right. Is that all right? And then what I'll do is the new stuff, I'll bank.
Yeah.
And then the next show, I'll do the same. Like, I'll try some interaction, chop some clips up, and then some of the stuff that works I might use, and then some of it I'll bank, and then from the Glasgow Comedy Festival I take that stuff that I've banked to the Edinburgh Fringe, and then I mix the bank stuff then with the stuff that I'm retesting.
Sure. Yeah. And then how have you found it, like, kind of playing to your audience, and like, did you build, are there people that came that followed you on like Facebook and that sort of stuff before, and then you built that again, and then it's new people coming now?
Everyone's through TikTok. Edinburgh Fringe is a bit different. People seen you in Breaking the News or whatever, but Blackfriars is like, I say, because I'm terrible, I ask the audience, I greet the audience when they're coming in, and I'll say, do you want to be in my head, did you see me? Stuff like that. Like, I saw you dying in your arse in London at a radio recording. but it's normally TikTok that they all say. And then again, the Glasgow Dad stuff. Yeah, I keep saying, Raymond's always like going mental, it's Glasgow Dad. I keep saying Glasgow Dad.
So for people who don't know, so what is that then?
So Glasgow Dad came from, so me and another comedian, Raymond Mearns, who's been very good to me, he's a mentor,
and to a lot of people in Scottish comedy, including theatres, I would say.
And to me, he's probably, probably no mind me saying, but he probably is, for me, the best improviser in Scotland in terms of on stage, emceeing, etc. So
yeah, because when you see quite a few MCs who have their own stock things that they'll say time and time again, Raymond is just genuinely off the cuff, and it's always fucking amazing.
Absolutely. And like, I've said this before on here, and people know, obviously, that have listened to his episode, it was easily one of our best episodes ever, and it was just him talking for an hour basically. But like, sometimes you'd be backstage when he'd be telling you, be chatting halfway through, and like, Raymond, the show's about to start, and just get up and walk on stage and keep telling the story to the audience, and it works. And you're like, how is this even possible? But he's brilliant.
Yeah, so he directed my Gordon Ramsay Cama Cafe show for Edinburgh, although he keeps telling me, you never fucking delivered it right. So that's what you want to know after a month of the Fringe. But to be fair, probably didn't, because it was quite personal. And but anyway, so we just work with each other. We meet up maybe every Thursday, every second Thursday. We chat through ideas, and I just said to him one day, I said, "What if you were my dad? What if you were my dog?" And then he just,
so you getting interviewed for Bible John?
I said, "What if you were my dad and you gave me a written?" And he was like, "Fucking your dad? What the fuck do you mean?" I went, "Boom! That's it. That's exactly." So we just we did a phone call where we filmed me asking him a question, and he sort of slams me and I reply, and we put them out on TikTok, and it done really well.
Aye.
And it blew up a bit, and some clips went, I guess, can you say viral now or whatever?
Sure.
Everything's viral online, but I think it went really well, and we enjoy working with each other. And then, we just, again, through TikTok, we just started, like, people were buying tickets to come and see us live.
Yeah.
And the live shows were going great. And now we launched the Glasgow Dad podcast last week. And it's going great so far. And brilliant. People are starting to enjoy it. So.
And so see, in the pod, do you just talk to each other in character then? Or?
Yeah, so he's Glasgow Dad's Glasgow Dad, which is basically Raymond with a hat and glasses. If that's a character, he fucking nails it.
Yeah, he's been doing some Daniel Day-Lewis shit for like 30 years.
I know, he's like, I fucking carousel, I think of myself, put a hat and glasses on, fucking. So, but no, and it works really well, and I'm like a, I'm like his, what he believes is his woke son.
Aye.
So he's trying to teach me from his day what worked, and I'm trying to say to him, well, it's 2024 now, it's not like 1970, do you know what I mean? Camden.
Can't call him the swamp donkey anymore.
Exactly. Turn your Roy Chubby Brown DVD off and let's we just talk about different things, and we literally just turn up and we talk about what happened that week or general things, and we just roll with it, and it works really well, and the chemistry we've got with each other off stage tends to really work in that character.
Absolutely.
As well, so
that's great.
No, that's great. And it's like you're saying about diversifying and all that kind of stuff, and Because you like, I think if you've done Breaking the News more than anyone else.
Yes, I'm the longest running panellist.
Yeah.
So I've been, I don't know if I've done it more than anyone else in terms of, I've never, like,
counted the
episodes. I'll leave that to you. But, no, but I've not counted the episode, but I know I'm the longest running panellist.
Yeah. So what, were you on like the first one? Or?
Yeah, I was on, I think it was either episode one or two.
Right.
But I was on the read through at the Glasgow Stand.
Oh, wow.
So there was a read through with me. There's some people that have been cancelled. So until I get cancelled, I'm the runner.
Last one standing. No, because that's because I remember when I started doing it, I spoke to you for a wee bit of advice, just because you're always great on those things, and I think it's such an interesting sort of skill set to have, like to be able to do that type of show, like a kind of panel show type of thing, because it probably takes a certain type of comic, I suppose. And then, but these days it's interesting how you do all that. You do the TikTok stuff, and kind of everybody needs to do that now, really. Like, you need to find something,
diversify, like you were saying,
something that you can use your skills that you've developed through doing live shows or whatever for years, and then finding a way to do it on TikTok or on Instagram or whatever.
It's interesting because, like, people say Live at the Apollo and all that sort of thing, and Live at the Apollo for me, so if I ever got offered Live at the Apollo, where it would be great for me is to use to cut up and put on TikTok.
Absolutely.
So that's the only real reason, for instance, if there's ever any TV recordings, I, of course, are good to do. But now I think having quality filmed and edited material that you can put in TikTok from a show like that can work wonders for you. I think that's...
Absolutely. And that's, you see that with loads of folk that have done it, and that's the people that have done the best of folk that have managed to be able to do that, eh?
But it's amazing. I think why I work so well in that show, I think, is because I am known for my one-liners. So if you speak to the editing team, they'll say you're an editor's dream.
Aye.
Because they'll say in Desi's ear, go to Stuart. Aye. And then they'll know I'll have something to wrap it all up.
Yeah. Wee zinger.
A wee zinger.
Have you got any zingers to wrap this up?
I was actually going to say, because we were going to start with this, but in terms of just bad gigs and all that, have you got any horror story gigs or anything your kind of classic worst gig sort of story or anything like that?
So two really. So I had a really bad gig at the Edinburgh Fringe, as everyone does,
sure,
I guess, and it was in the Waverley Bar.
Uh-huh.
And if you've been in the Wave, there's a flat screen TV.
Yeah.
And a guy just went, oh, gonna see what's on the fucking telly. And then you've gone into the audience, are just tough. Let's shut off. And then when I was starting out, a comic, Patrick Rowlink, got me doing a gig in Wishaw, and a dog bit my ankle.
You're glad she came.
I get bit with a dog.
Fucking hell.
Unbelievable.
Did you have? Did you continue the gig after that?
No, I went to get a tetanus.
That's a good reason for no day in your time, isn't it? Aye. If only there could be a few more dogs at corporates.
Doing 20, just give me a wee bite on the ankle at 17. So no,
listen, Stuart, thank you so much for joining us. It's been brilliant having you on.
It's been great having you on. Have you got anything to plug up? You've got the Radio 4 show.
Yeah, so the Radio 4 show is coming out on Sunday the 25th.
What's it
February.
Called?
It's called Stuart Mitchell Cost 11.
Yeah. Right.
And it's on at 7:15, so the 25th, Sunday the 25th. Glasgow Comedy Festival. I've got my own shows during the Glasgow Comedy Festival, so check out them.
Yeah, Blackfriars as well.
All Blackfriars. Nice. And then the Glasgada live recordings of the podcast is going to be the 17th and the 31st of March.
Yeah, so that's in the afternoon, because the 31st is when we're doing live the Pavilion live show, so that's... Yeah.
You nearly said live at the Apollo.
I was just doing it for the clips, but that's... But aye, so, well, you know, if you want to go to that and then come and see us in the evening, then double up. But and that's with Raymond, obviously, the Glasgow Dad ones there, so...
Aye, me and Raymond doing character, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Stuart, thank you so much for joining us, mate. And where can people find you online, actually, quickly?
Yeah, so just in TikTok, Stuart Mitchell Comedy. and you'll find me on there.
Perfect.
Great.
Great stuff.
Smash it.
Cheers. Thanks very much. No worries.
Thanks, Omi. As ever, just please remember to like and subscribe. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can follow us at Some Laugh Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. And send any questions you've got to our email address, which is somelaughpod@gmail.com. As mentioned, obviously, do sign up to the Patreon, and we still have tickets available for Some Laugh Live at the Pavilion on the 31st of March as well. Aside from all that, guys, thanks a lot for tuning in, and we'll speak to you very soon.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.